Hi, I'm Laura from Hudson at the Hudson Farmers Market. You're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM Hands-On Radio.
Common Ground is a private, not-for-profit organization offering dispute resolution services to the people in Columbia and Greene counties. Common Ground provides trained mediators who work to resolve the differences between two or more participants on issues including family, housing, business, workplace, school, and neighborhood disputes. The mediation process is informal, private, confidential, and voluntary. For more information, please contact Common Ground at 518-943-0523 or on our website www.commongroundinc.org.
Wave Farm programs are made possible, in part, by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of Governor Andrew Cuomo and the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program administered in Greene County by the Greene County Council on the Arts, the Alexander and Marjorie Hover Foundation, the Foundation for Contemporary Arts, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Peter W. Bone of Gilboa, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Give me liberty, or give me death.
WGXC, the station that gives you liberty.
As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster.
I know I'd go from rags to riches. You would only say you care. And though my pocket may be empty, I'd be a millionaire. My clothes may still be torn and tattered.
To me, being a gangster was better than being President of the United States.
Hello and welcome to a myriad of musings and music with the ninth grade of Berkshire Country Day School. I'm Esme and here with me is
Lana,
Rafi,
Eli,
Miles,
and Nora.
For this month's interview, we interviewed State Representative Smitty Pignatelli of Berkshire County.
Okay, so why did you originally choose to run for public office?
Well, I grew up in Lenox. My father was a longtime Lenox selectman for 32 years. Actually, he's the longest serving selectman in Lenox history. So I learned at a very early age, going to work for my father in the summertime. My father got a lot of joy of public service, and he liked being in a position to help people. And I found the joy that he got in doing that. And I said, you know what? I never thought I'd be where I am today, to be very honest with you. But I knew that I wanted to do something in my community to make life better for people, and that's what kind of caught my fire.
Well, and what was your journey to becoming a state representative like?
My journey to be a state representative was kind of an interesting path, and I always love to tell young people that, you know, we all may have a goal of where we want to be, but there's no such thing as a straight line. You know, I've taken a lot of detours in my life to get to where I am today, but like I said, I wanted to get involved in my community. I was a special policeman when I was 17 years old. I served on the Energy Committee during the energy crisis of the early 80s when elderly people were having a hard time paying for fuel to heat their house or to weather strip old windows and things like that. So I got involved 18, 19 years of age. And then when I was 25, I wanted to get more involved in the development of the town. So I ran for the Planning Board, which really helped shape the zoning of the town. I said, you know, I really kind of enjoy this, and I think I want to do more. And then there was an opening for the Board of Selectmen. So I actually ran for Board of Selectmen, served there for 11 years, and then when my predecessor as state representative decided to retire, I said, you know what, my name kept popping to the top in people's minds. It's, Smitty will be a good state rep. And so I left a very good job, making more money then than I am making today, to run for state representative. But I feel very happy, and I feel very, very gratified that I'm doing good things for people. And I always tell young people, don't ever chase a job for the money. Chase a job for the passion for the work that you do. And I feel I still have a lot of passion for the work that I do.
So do you remember, or what was the first bill that you remember getting passed that you were proud of?
Well, there's one bill that I took particular pride in my first term, and I've been in the legislature 17 years now. The Department of Revenue, which is the agency in the state that collects taxes, I felt as a selectman that they were overcharging the town of Lenox on the collection of the hotel motel tax to the tune of about $750,000. And that was a lot of money for a small town or any town at that time, but certainly is a lot of money today even. So I filed a bill against the wishes of the select board. They thought it was a waste of time. They thought we were just going to waste time and money and effort. And that bill got passed and signed by the governor. And I was very proud of that. And Lenox got their $750,000 back. So that was my first entry to state government. It sometimes can be a very complicated process, legislation. But as a freshman legislator, to file a big bill that was impacting my hometown and be successful with it really kind of solidified my credibility in the state house, built a lot of friendships along the way, and it kind of helped pave the way for me to have a good career here.
So do you think you've learned anything since that first bill you got passed?
Like, I never stop learning. In fact, I always tell people that the day I stop learning is the day that I need to leave office. So I'm always searching for new and better ways to do things. So I read more than I ever did in my life in this job. I think it's critically important to never stop learning, no matter what you're trying to accomplish. We've done some monumental, historic things in Massachusetts in my time in the legislature. And when you stop learning, you stop living. So keep learning.
Is there a bill you wish you could have worked on more? More effort, determination?
Well, that's hard to say. I wish we could do more in our infrastructure. We're still working to try to navigate that. I represent the largest geographic district in the House of Representatives. We get elected by population. I represent 20 communities, from Richmond here in Massachusetts to Russell, which is down near Westfield, and from Washington to Mount Washington. It's a very large swath of land mass in Massachusetts, 20 towns, 40,000 people. My best friend in the legislature represents 40,000 people in 4.5 square miles of West Roxbury. So our interests are very different, but yet they're very similar. But I think infrastructure, roads, bridges, sewer, water, I think the state has an obligation and an opportunity to partner with our partners in government, namely town selectmen, to try to solve some of those problems, because without the state's assistance, those are the issues that, in my opinion, will bankrupt small towns all throughout the Commonwealth.
So what bill that you passed do you think was most popular among the 40,000 constituents or?
Well, the bill,
doesn't necessarily have to be the bill that you were proud of, but
yeah.
Just that was...
I don't think there's a bill that I passed. There's bills that we've passed. And I think it's awesome to have young people here, classmates, because there's nothing that you can do as an individual without your team. So when I look back to my first couple of terms, same-sex marriage, that was a huge issue. I actually gave my maiden speech to the legislature on same-sex marriage. And that was a very controversial issue in the country. We became the first state in America to allow same-sex couples to marry each other. It was a challenging time. There were 400 press credentials requested to be at that debate from all over the world, from as far away as Japan and Australia. The eyes of the world were on Massachusetts legislature at that time. We were locked down in the House of Representatives. There were thousands of people inside the building, very passionately on both sides of the issue. It wasn't until I got home at night, 11 o'clock, turned on 11 o'clock news, and found that there was thousands more on the Boston Common very passionately fighting on each side of that issue. I felt compelled, doing a lot of research and doing my homework, that this was a civil rights issue of my generation, and I stood up and gave my maiden speech. I felt I was willing to put my reputation and my career on the line for this, and it passed, and it became a model for what's going on in America. So that's why I'm extremely proud of that aspect. And then just 2 years later, we have a lot of continuing debate about health care. You know, how do we afford health care? How do we give people health care coverage? So we became the first state in the country again to have a requirement for health care for every citizen of Massachusetts. We hear a lot on the national level about Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. The Obamacare was patterned after Massachusetts. We were the first state to do it. And what they pretty much did, for the most part, was they took out the national, they took out Massachusetts and they pushed in America. So I feel that we are part of a generation landmark piece of legislation for healthcare for all, which is the model for America today.
And how do you make sure everyone's voice is heard and they feel as though they're being represented through your work?
Yeah, that's always a challenge. Like I say, I represent 40,000 people, and you know, I'd be lying to you if I told you I've talked to all 40,000 people. But with email and social media, there's very easy ways to get a hold of your elected representatives today. But I take great pride in listening to people. My dad would always tell me that talk to as many people as possible, because someone may have an idea that you've never thought of. And so I think that's the only way that I can learn, is by talking to people and getting your perspective of things. And that might help shape or reshape my opinion as well. And I wish more elected officials had that same attitude. I serve with people, and I have served with people that think they have it all figured out. I emphasize have served with people, because they're no longer there. The ones who think they've got it all figured out have a lot to learn. I always try to learn and continue to learn.
What made you choose, if you had a choice, to be on the Joint Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, and Agriculture?
Well, I really didn't have a choice. We serve every 2 years at the pleasure of the Speaker of the House, who appoints chairs of the committees, and I was chosen to be the chair of the Environment Committee. And it's a committee that I've never served on, but when the Speaker called me up, and when I think about it now, we are rich with open space. We are rich with farms here in Western Massachusetts. We are rich in our natural natural history and natural byproduct. And I thought that's a perfect place for me to go. And I've enjoyed it very much. But we serve. But next January, not this coming January, January 2021, assuming I get reelected next fall, the Speaker may say, Smitty, I'm going to put you over someplace else. So every 2 years, we get reallocated our committees on this.
So you said that your team is like an important part of how you work together. What do you think are some of the most important qualities that you have for someone in your team, just that you have in general?
For me personally?
Yeah.
I think the understanding of my district, the appreciation of the history of my district, the willingness and the ability to listen to people, to try to pick your brain. I love being devil's advocate. I love playing good cop, bad cop. That's my way of learning things. But have you thought about this? And I want to hear what your response is, and that helps shape me. So I think listening to people and be willing to kind of get to their degree of understanding and experience. But then I look at my life experience. You know, growing up in the Berkshires, I have three sisters. We talk a lot about equal pay for gender pay. Of course I want my sisters to make the same amount of money that I make. That's a natural thing. My daughter is 25 years old, living in California, working in television. I want to make sure she gets equal pay for equal work, so I can relate to those things. I'm a divorced man, so I can understand, you know, the struggles that people have as divorced parents or single parents, sometimes what they go through. I was in business for myself. I understand what it takes to, you know, make payroll and pay your health insurance, workers' comp. I tap into those life experiences probably every day of my life, which helps me, I think, make me a better legislator.
And why do you like being a state representative? And you are very popular among your constituents. And would you ever consider representing Massachusetts in the U.S. House of Representatives?
Well, there was a lot of questions there. I love being a state representative. The beauty of being a representative versus a senator or even a U.S. representative is by nature of the House of Representatives, we are closer to the people. So in my time, and even in the last 10 years, I've had two opportunities to run for the state Senate, and I've turned it away both times because I love being a rep. I love the hands-on. I love the approach. And I just think it's more personal. I'm more connected with my people. And I have no regrets, and I have no desire, absolutely no desire to run for Congress. I think the dysfunction of our federal government is an embarrassment. I'm embarrassed for the Democrats as well as the Republicans. I'm a Democrat, but I blame both parties, not keeping what the needs of America are in mind when they go down there to legislate. So I would find myself too frustrated. I admire people who are down there, but I want to make sure that we elect people who are down there for the right reasons. I want public service to be public service, not self-service. And I think a lot of our politics today is turning into self-service, not public service. That worries me. That worries me greatly. And I think we need to have a greater perspective of that at the local level, at the state level, and certainly at the federal level.
Okay, so what is it like working under the current administration, both locally and nationally?
Well, locally, I think it's wonderful. We have a democratically controlled House of Representatives and state Senate. All of our constitutional officers in Massachusetts are Democrats, but yet we somehow elect a Republican governor. Why is that? The only thing I can figure out is, and this is the answer I give all the time, is that people, like you say, we like Smitty. We like him as our representative, but I don't trust the rest of them. So let's give them a Republican governor to keep an eye on this guy and the body of the legislature. So that's the only answer I could have, because prior to Deval Patrick, we had 20 years of Republican governors. Since Deval Patrick, we're in our fifth year of Republican governors. So, but this governor is very different. I got sworn in the day before Mitt Romney became our governor, who's now a U.S. senator in Utah and ran for president of the United States. And this governor, in order for him to be effective, he knows he's outnumbered by the Democrats. But in order for me to be successful, I need to work with the Democratic legislature. He does that beautifully, probably better than any Republican governor I've served under. I've served under four governors. Governor Baker gets it. We can agree to disagree on a lot of issues, but his approach is very different. He's willing to listen. I have a meeting with him in a couple of weeks, and we're just going to brainstorm. We get together every few months. We just brainstorm. Some governors take on the approach that, oh, you're a Democrat. I don't need to talk to you. Well, I want to be successful. You want to be successful. We have different philosophical views politically. But how can we find that common ground so that we're both successful? This administration does it very well. The dysfunction in Washington is because the parties are too divided. And I think until we get both parties to recognize that we have to work together for the greater good, to solve our roads and bridges that are deteriorating, to solve poverty, to solve the health care issues, to rebuild our roads and our hospitals and our schools, there's got to be some commonality, irregardless of party, that we can find some common ground for the greater good. They're not even doing that. And that's why we have such discourse politically in Washington.
And is there something you would say to people listening to this show about having conversations with people who don't necessarily agree with what they're thinking and might believe in something different, like to find common ground? And is there a way that you find common ground?
I say to the folks in Congress, I say, do your job. Do your job. Remember why you got elected. Remember who you represent. And I think what I do there, again, by learning and listening and reaching across the aisle, some of the best pieces of the legislation are done in a bipartisan way. And I think that we need to have more of that. I've never believed that I'm the smartest guy in the legislature and my ideas are the best. But don't be afraid to throw an idea out there and let's see how you respond to it. Hey, Smitty, have you thought about this? Really, I really haven't, but can you explain it to me that further? and then we can help craft it and reshape it. I filed a bill years ago. I'm a huge believer of acupuncture. Now, here we are. We have an opioid epidemic throughout the country, but certainly here in Massachusetts. Why do we keep prescribing pain medications if there's other integrative forms of treatment we can give to people, like acupuncture, like physical therapy, changing your diet? Those are integrative approaches we try to make. I'm very proud to announce right now, starting January 1, 2020, Blue Cross Blue Shield, the biggest insurance company in Massachusetts, is going to cover acupuncture for alternative treatments. Now, my next challenge is to get the other insurance companies to follow suit. So they have finally recognized acupuncture, for an example, saves money. It saves the insurance company's money. It saves the individual money. And it's non-addictive, non-invasive, and I'm not popping a pill for a pain in my elbow. But that's what we've done. Take two aspirin, call me in the morning. Now it's take two Vicodins, take two Percocets, and call me in the morning. And don't be surprised if 6 months later you become addicted. You know, so the opioid epidemic is a real serious problem. We've had great success treating opioid addiction with acupuncture. We've had wonderful success treating returning veterans battling PTSD with acupuncture. Things that we historically would prescribe a pill to, now we're able to prescribe acupuncture and have it covered by insurance. This is a huge milestone victory for the Commonwealth.
What other alternatives are there that you've come up with or created, like acupuncture or like...
Yeah, I think physical therapy is one. I think we have an obesity problem in this country. I mean, trying to get you to change your diet, and you're not obese by any stretch, but trying to get people to change their diet or to exercise more, be more conscientious of, you know, your lifestyle. I think to go take a walk in Kennedy Park. That embracing nature has been proven to be very therapeutic for people. Mental illness is real in this country. We could talk all day about that. There's problems that we have in America with young people and old. It's not just a young people situation, but there's other integrative treatments that we could use that are proven to be very successful.
But how does that cover serious injuries? If I come to the hospital and I break, fracture my spine or a serious painful injury,
yeah,
and I'm given these dangerous pain medications, and how does that work? How do you? Because actually, I don't know, but acupuncture doesn't necessarily cover my spine.
You're absolutely right. It's not for everybody. Yeah, and that's a great question, and it's a great point you're making. Because it's not for everybody. But when my 16-year-old daughter, who is probably 90 pounds soaking wet, had her wisdom teeth taken out, and the dentist prescribed a 30-day supply of Oxycontin, I question, why does she need a 30-day supply of Oxycontin for wisdom teeth? I had my wisdom teeth taken out. They sent me home, say, take two Tylenol and call me in the morning if you have any problems. I went to work the next day. I felt like crap, but I went to work the next day. My 16-year-old daughter, 90 pounds, did not need a 30-day supply of Oxycontin. So we've done much better with monitoring what doctors are prescribing, who they're prescribing to, how much they're prescribing, and maybe we can control that back. Now you as a patient can say, I don't want a 30-day supply. I want a partial fill. So you could ask for a 5-day supply, not a 30-day supply. Because you may take one, have an adverse reaction, and never take those again. Well, you got 29 more pills in that medicine cabinet that sometimes can get into the wrong hands, and then the addiction process starts all over again. So, you're absolutely right. Walking through the woods, acupuncture, physical therapy, diet is not going to fix a broken arm if you're in that much pain. It's not going to treat the cancer patient. Although, we've had great success with cancer patients with acupuncture. Hillcrest Hospital Cancer Center is using acupuncture. Dana-Farber in Boston is treating people with acupuncture. So, not for everybody, but just don't say, take the pill, because there's nothing else to offer. Now we have other menus to offer, items to offer.
Was there a major world event that changed the way that you view the world?
For me, you guys are all too young, but 9/11. I think 9/11 changed my life dramatically. I have a very dear friend who lost her best friend in the very first plane that went into the Trade Towers. So that, I remember that time, and you guys have all grown up. Your entire life, this country's been at war. I remember peacetime when I was your age. the Vietnam War was over and, you know, America was America. You guys only know this country at war. I think that's a sad commentary on society, but 9/11 changed our entire life. I remember working at a local bank, and this is just 2001, obviously. There was only one computer in the entire bank that had internet. So I'm in my office, and the lady outside my office says, "Smitty, come check this out. They just flew a plane." We all huddled around her desk the entire day watching this all unfold. Look at where we are with the internet. These things that we have, these smartphones, and we have computers in our palm of my hands right now. Just 18 years ago, that was not the case. So it's changed the world in many positive ways, but it's changed the world in some very serious ways that I'm excited to have young people taking life a little more seriously about what you can do to change the role going forward. But that personally changed my life on a personal and a professional level.
How do you think younger generations can use, well, we've never gone through 9/11, but we can use the education and knowledge to, I guess, more understand it or more make awareness, possibly?
That's probably a question I should be asking you. What can you do to help me? But I think, you know, mental health is real. I think the trauma of 9/11 has had some serious consequences on the world. And I think, you know, from the school shootings to just the shootings at a Las Vegas music festival a couple of years ago, something dramatically is going on in this country that doesn't happen in any other country in the world. Why is that? We got to get to the root of the problem. We need treatment for opioid addiction, but we also need to spend time on the root problem that caused the addiction to begin with in the first place. And I think that's where I'm going to lean on you guys, that how can we help each other have a better life?
I guess to change the topic, to go more into your childhood, where did you go to school and how does that affect you today?
Well,
what did you go to school for? And I guess you can...
Because I had to go to school, right? I grew up in Lenox, born and raised here. My father was born and raised here, just half a mile down the road. Went to the Lenox Public Schools. I never went to college. My father was an electrical contractor. I went to work for him when I was 11 years old, and Smitty was going to run the family business. So I went to trade school after high school, took over the family business, became a master electrician at the age of 19, and I thought my career was set. I was ready to go. And then when I turned 38, I said, you know what, I've been doing this for close to 30 years. I don't think I want to do it any longer, and I changed careers, went to work at a local bank. I went back to Babson College down near Boston to the Executive School of Management, and would have had a good career at a bank until this opportunity came up. So, like I said, there's no straight line for whatever career path you take, but you're talking to a state representative that started out as an electrician. And I think that's the beauty of the House of Representatives, that this is lawyers in the House of Representatives, but there's electricians, there's doctors, there's a nurse, there's a tree surgeon. We are truly representative of the people that we serve, and I think that's what makes the House so special.
Is there a specific person or someone who changed the way you viewed politics and changed the way you changed?
I'm kind of a history nut. I love the Civil War era, to be honest with you, and I really admired Abraham Lincoln. What he did, but there was nobody better than my father. My father was a product of World War II. He lost his best friend in that war. His name was Smitty. That's where I got my name. But my father's approach to public service was in the purest form. He was there simply to help people. And it wasn't about him. My father wasn't a wealthy man, but he was rich with friends and rich with the ability to find a way to help you, no matter what it was. And some of my greatest successes are patterned after my father that you probably will never read about in the newspaper. When I was your age, I would get frustrated with my dad to say, why are you letting somebody else take credit for things that I know you did? He says, I know what I did. They know what I did. I'm very happy. He didn't need that line. I don't need that line. I just want to do good work.
Yeah, and in your good work, you've done a lot of good work, but do you have any regrets about decisions that you feel you should have been more outspoken towards, or votes that you look back on now and think you made the wrong choice?
That's a great question. Right now, I have no regrets. I'm sure someday when I retire, I'll look back and say, boy, I wish I would have been more successful on this, whatever this may be. But at this point, no, I get frustrated as I get older, but I have no regrets. I think we've done some good things. I've taken great pride in them. And we've done some landmark things that historically we will look back on and say, you know what? This is what we did for healthcare for all. This is what we did for same-sex marriage. You know what? I was there. I cast a vote. I raised my hand and I spoke up. Those are things I'll be very proud of in retrospect when I'm old and in my rocking chair.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for letting us interview you today. You are truly a shining example of how politicians should behave, and we are very appreciative for that example that you've set for all of us.
Well, I appreciate it very much, and I love when young people get involved because you're our future. When I'm an old man, I want one of you to be in my seat doing something very positive for the next generation. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Now we are going to transition to the current events segment. For the first current event, we decided to interview the Hudson Police Chief on the new New York State bail laws.
Okay, so our first question we had was just, how did you become a policeman?
So it's funny you're here this week, because I got sworn in the state police 39 years ago this week, a couple days ago. So I was real young. And what got me into it, because no one in my police in my family were ever in the police department, you know. But there was a couple local troopers that were members of my church and are members of my community, and I admired them very much. And my brother was a town justice south of here, so he was involved a lot with law enforcement. So I kind of got introduced through him to some state troopers, and I thought at the time might be something I might be interested in doing.
Cool.
Nice. So what do you think is the toughest part about this job for you, at least?
Well, I think it changes over time. I think perceptions of what we do and why we do it have changed a little bit. There's a lot of national issues that apply to policing and justice and you know, professional standards that don't always apply to a small department or my experience. So the toughest job is just getting the information out there that we are doing the right thing, trying to be honest, trying to work hard for our citizens. So there's a lot. There's shift. I could talk about a lot of things. There's shift work. There's working nights. That's tough. Uh-huh. There's separation from your family during holidays and things like that. There's long hours. So there's parts that you accept with the job, mm-hmm. but those are difficult things when you're raising a family and being away a lot. Sometimes that's difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So do you think you could just talk a little bit about the new bail laws and just what they are
in
general? Because we don't know a lot about them.
So what happens with the new bail law, it's going to take effect in January, and there's a lot of parts to it. So part of the issue is this really hasn't been debated before it became law. It really wasn't debated in the legislature and the newspapers locally. It just kind of went through and was put on us. Well, I think it was attached to a budget bill or something like that. So it was able to get approved through some mechanism of government. But there wasn't a lot of discussion, because when you put out a large, massive bill like that, law, there's a lot of little parts to it that people are wondering, well, what do we do when this happens, and what happens when this happens? So it's kind of like putting the cart before the horse. Now we got to figure out what we're going to do. Sometimes we call them unfunded mandates. There's things that the government's requiring us to do that we simply don't have the money for. So I guess what's going on is a little bit of panic, a little bit of confusion over the law, probably a little bit too much emotion, And it's all happening at once, so it makes everything a little confusing and difficult.
Oh, yeah. So, what is it? What will happen when this bail
off? Okay, so up till now, when we make an arrest for crimes, now crimes are misdemeanors, and then the heavier crimes are felonies, right? So up to this time, we could take a misdemeanor or felony and have the defendant, the alleged person that caused the crime, to go in front of the judge. The judge would evaluate what happened or what's alleged to have happened, and then could put bail, could have the person require go to jail or post bail. So what does that tell you? You're going to automatically in that system have folks that can't afford, don't have any money, obviously are going to go to jail, and they can't find the means to get out. So I think the thinking behind this law was that that's inherently unfair. So what we're going to do is we're not going to take bail at all. We're not going to request bail at all for a whole bunch of crimes. So I think that's what the intent was, to make it more an equal system. But there's a lot of problems that come along with that. Uh-huh. So when you say that we're not going to take bail for any misdemeanors, or only specified misdemeanors, and we're not going to take bail for a lot of felonies, it's got people worried. And let me give you some examples. You could have someone burglarize your home and or rob you. Suppose you two guys rob me and things like that. We're not allowed to bring that person in front of the judge, and the judge have that person go to jail pending his trial, pending his court, whatever. He has to be given a ticket. A lot of crimes fit this now. Manslaughter, for example, vehicular manslaughter. If I killed someone with my car, I would get a ticket and be told to come back to court. And so you got all these crimes, burglary, assault, kidnapping, all this, a lot of different stuff people are concerned about. Hey, that guy's out now. I just had a domestic violence incident, and now he's back out and can, or assault. You can assault me again. So people are nervous. Then there's all sorts of disclosure rules and other things attached to the law. Mm-hmm. So let's take an assault, for example. If you have an assault or a robbery where you rob somebody, police do the information, they arrest you. They come in, they give you a ticket and say, okay, come back to court, on October 25th. Mm-hmm. Here's where it gets to be a problem. The guy doesn't show up. The court has to have the means to remind the guy to come back to court through text message or letters or personal contact. The person doesn't come again. It has to be done again. See, there's warrants and there's bench warrants. The judge can issue a bench warrant to say, hey, this guy didn't show up, so I'm going to give you an order, a warrant, to go out and pick him up again. Well, it's going to be interesting because that's a lot of work for a department.
Yeah.
To give a person two or three or four warnings and then ultimately have to go out and arrest him once again. There's so much to this, man. It's incredible.
Yeah.
Disclosure. We have to have a lot of the information involved in an arrest disclosed to the defense attorney within 15 days. That requires a lot of clerical work. So if I arrest you in that same robbery, all our radio transmissions, all the videos from the here in the station, all the reports, everything attached to that report has to go to the defense attorney within 15 days. That's a lot of work. So what I'm saying is probably confusing you a little bit, mm-hmm. and I don't mean to be that way. I'm just saying that whereas people used to go to jail right from the get-go, that's not going to happen anymore.
Mm-hmm. So after, let's say you didn't show up and you picked them up again, would they get another ticket and be freed again, or would they go to jail that time?
That's right. That's a very good question. No, they'll be released again. And only under certain circumstances will the judge ask for bail. And that's the problem, is right now here in the little city of Hudson, the court next door here issues about 200 to 250 bench warrants per year. Now, I want you to think about this. I only have 25 officers, okay? So that means on an average year, before this law, 250 times people were supposed to go to court, never showed up, and the judge issued a warrant to go get him again. Uh-huh. Okay? Now, can you imagine, throw on top of that, people that were never posting bail, uh-huh. that never have a chance of forfeiting bail, we might end up with 500 bench warrants.
Oh, my God.
I don't know how I'm going to be able to maintain that in this part. I don't have enough guys to go out and continually bring people back to court over and over again.
Oh.
And there's a lot to it. There's staffing. The jails have all sorts of issues. For example, do you know most of the people, 90% of the people that are in jail right now will be released?
Oh, really?
So what I'm saying is not prison, but the county jail, Sheriff Bartlett's jail over there. About most of the population of that jail will be released starting January 1. Now think about it. You got all these jailers over there, sheriff deputies working over there. You've got all this people that are working to support the jail. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do when there's 1 out of 10 people left in that jail? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different issues here.
Oh yeah, wow. So, is there any way you think, like, before until January 1st, or even during that, that because of this new bail law, you guys will change your methods somehow to try to adapt to this or cope with it?
Well, the first thing we took on was the new rules regarding discovery. So we're up to speed on that. We're probably way ahead of some departments, but we got right on that. We're already submitting all of our discovery information, all of the stuff attached to the report, all that paper. We're already doing it digitally within our 15 days. At least we're trying to. We're starting to get the... But I've had to use clerks and reassign people for different jobs in order to get that job done. Mm-hmm. So as far as the paperwork part of it, we're coming up to speed on that. As far as what we're going to change, that's an excellent, excellent question. I don't know that we're going to change everything. We're still going to conduct investigations. We're still going to arrest people. It's just the question of... securing these people back in court, is that going to change? Is that going to become more difficult?
Uh-huh.
You see, we don't have a say. The police don't have a say that as to what's right and wrong.
Yeah.
This is what our laws dictate, and we're going to do our best to enforce them within the rules.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great.
Yeah.
You guys got any other questions? I mean, you're going to read a lot about this,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, definitely.
And I think I understand why they passed the law.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to tell you it's difficult, and I wouldn't be surprised if the law gets modified.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of public concern. Let me give you one example. Don't want to go too long, but
no.
There is a burglary in your house, let's suppose a guy comes in and burglarizes your house. Under the new laws, he'll be able to petition the court to visit the alleged crime scene, which means you would be forced to allow the guy back in your house so he can look around and prepare his defense. Of course, he'd be supervised by somebody, but that's just one little part of it.
People must be worried about.
They're worried about stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like I say, people, our way of thinking now is a person beats someone up, a person steals from somebody, a person's drunk and kills somebody. We just have it in our mind that that person's going to get arrested and go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
That way of thinking is going to be over. That person will be back on the streets hours after the event happened. And I don't think we're ready to the public's ready to wrap their mind around that.
Do you know if other states have this?
I don't know about other states. There's been all sorts of bail reform all over, different ways all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
There's been decriminalization of some drug laws and stuff like that. So every state's a little different. This is pretty drastic.
Mm-hmm.
This is pretty drastic.
I know in Massachusetts where I go to school, they have like a dangerousness hearing. So if you, they
to evaluate
go before
what,
a judge
yeah.
and then maybe you'll go to jail, maybe you'll just go to
see, a lot of people will tell you guys that the only reason we have bail is to secure the people back in court. Okay, so the only reason, so if this guy's from Hudson and he assaults someone, he's always been from Hudson, he's going to come back to court. Why do you need to take bail from him? But that's a fallacy. The reason for bail isn't solely to make sure the person comes back to court. The judge should take into account all sorts of factors. What is the danger to the public presented by this person being back? What is his state of mind? Is the guy got a place to live? Does he make a living? Does he have a job? Is he employed? What are the conditions surrounding this event that happened and victimized someone?
Yeah.
So it isn't. So when people tell you that bail is simply to make sure the guy secure the guy back, of course, not 100% true. This is about public safety, and the judge representing public safety as we do, to see what's best for our citizens and how can our citizens be safe. There's a lot. You guys have picked a pretty tough subject.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Great.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Now, Eli is going to tell us a little bit about how impeachment works.
Okay, so as you may know, we are in the process of impeachment. What has happened already is the first step, which is the formal impeachment inquiry being announced in the House by Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi. The second step, which we are in the middle of, is the formal inquiry by the House Intelligence Committee, led by Adam B. Schiff, the chairman of the committee. The Intelligence Committee will look for evidence that the president has committed treason, bribery, or other high crimes or misdemeanors. Once the committee is done with their investigation, the process will move to the next step, in which the House Judiciary Committee will vote on and decide whether there are grounds for impeachment. If there are, the Judiciary Committee then writes up articles of impeachment. These are voted on in the full House. If the full House votes yes on any of these articles, they are sent to the Senate for a trial. Once it reaches the Senate, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell will decide whether to hold a Senate trial. If the Senate trial happens, the President will be summoned to appear and address the charges. If he does not appear, the Senate would operate as if he had pled not guilty. During the trial, House lawmakers who are designated to argue the case for impeachment outline charges, and the president's attorneys defend him. Both sides may call and cross-examine witnesses. Once the trial is completed, the Senate will vote on whether to impeach the president. This requires a two-thirds majority, and if this majority is not reached, then the president will not be impeached.
So now we're going to begin a music segment, and so the first song up on the agenda is was suggested actually by Representative Pignatelli, who we've interviewed earlier in this segment, and his suggested song was "Happy" by Pharrell Williams, and he has a radio show for himself, and he plays this song on his radio show, Always to Begin. So we're going to begin with it as well.
It might seem crazy what I'm about to say. Happiness is to you, because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel happiness into you.
Because I'm happy.
Clap along if you feel like that's what you want to do.
Because I'm happy.
Clap along if you feel like a room without a roof.
Because I'm happy.
Clap along if you feel like happiness is the truth.
Because
some of my favorite Elton John songs, including Mona Lisa's and Mad Hatter's, which is going to play right now.
Spanish Harlem are not just pretty words to say. I thought I knew, but now I know that rose trees never grow York City. Until you've seen this trash can dream come true, you stand at the edge while people run you through. And I thank the Lord there's people out there like you. I thank the Lord there's people out there like you. While Mona Lisa's and Mad Hatter's, sons of bankers, sons of lawyers, turn around and say good morning to the night. For unless they see the sky, but they can, and that is why. They know not if it's dark outside or light. This Broadway's got, it's got a lot of songs to sing. If I knew the tunes, I might join in. I go my way alone, grow my own seed shall be sown in New York City. Subway's no way for a good man to go down. Rich man can ride, and the hobo, he can drown. I thank the Lord for the people I have found. I thank the Lord for the people I have found. While Mona Lisa's and Mad Hatter's, sons of bankers, sons of lawyers, turn around and say good morning to the night. For unless they see the sky, but they can, and that is why. No, not if it's dark outside or light. Now I know Spanish Harlem are not just
pretty words to say. I thought I knew, but now I know that rose trees never grow. New York City subway's no way for a good man to go down. Rich man can ride, and the hobo he can drown. And I thank the Lord for the people I have found. I thank the Lord for the people I. While Mona Lisa's and Mad Hatters, sons of bankers, sons of lawyers, turn around and say good morning to the night. For unless they see the sky, but they can, and that is why. They know not if it's dark outside or light. No, not if it's dark outside or light.
Thank you for listening to A Myriad of Musings and Music with the Ninth Grade. Please be sure to tune in the first Wednesday of every month at 7 p.m.
This is I Guess That's Why They Call It the Blues by Elton John. And it's another one of my favorite songs by Elton. And here we go.
Don't wish it away, don't look at it like it's forever. Between you and me, I could honestly say that things can only get better. Before you and me run to the place that our hearts will we hide. And I guess that's why they call it the blues. Time on my hands, the time spent with you. Loving like children, living like lovers. Just stare into space, picture my face in your hand.